it's good to be the king. Unless, of course, you have no clothes. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Well, maybe good to be the king, but as for being a subject, well, not so much.
Well, all kings have to have subjects.
Yes.
But some kings tend to think that everybody should bow to them. But usually what happens with people like that, Charles, is that they end up bowing out.
Well, exactly. One way or another.
Voluntarily or otherwise, exactly. As history has shown. Today we're going to be talking a lot about wannabe kings. And I say that fully with tongue planted in cheek, because we are still talking about the United States presidential election season. And we're going to be talking about both Republicans and Democrats. Now, on our last program, which was right before the Democratic presidential primary debate, we talked about the main five front runners for the Democratic nomination. And we said we're going to talk about all of them, including all the smaller fish in the pot. But what we have to talk about first, Chuck, today, is that one of the big fish jumped out of the pond.
Jumped right out of the pond, and honestly, wisely so.
Smartly so, understanding that the water was getting toxic. It was just announced earlier this week that former Virginia Senator Jim Webb, who was a declared candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States for this upcoming election, has decided that there is really no room for him in the Democratic presidential primary. Now, he comes to that realization, Chuck, on the heels of a number of things which many candidates face, which is lack of appearance in polls, you know, or lack of moving in the polls in the right direction, the lack of financial resources coming to them from donors or PACs to help move their campaign message forward. And for Webb, and one of his announced reasons for this departure was the realization during that Democratic debate that the game was fixed, that there was no way that even the Democratic Party was going to allow anybody outside of who's considered the front runner, which is Hillary Clinton and or Bernie Sanders, take your pick on which side of that you're on, for anybody else to get any kind of visibility or notice or to be able to engage on policy issues, whether during the debate cycle or through the Democratic Party's own PR machine. And so Webb, I think wisely, I think you're right, decided it was time for him to depart the Democratic primary. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that doesn't mean that he's out completely. Because what he's doing right now is he's sitting down with his core team and he's exploring the possibility of an independent run for the presidency. In other words, if the Democratic Party won't let me get my message out within the party structure in a primary, they're going to have to put up with me in a general election where I can pull votes away from their nominee. Chuck, I think it's an incredibly wise strategy on his part. Because also by getting out of the Democratic primary, he's also opened up many doors because, as you and I were talking on the phone the other day, you have to remember, Jim Webb worked in Republican administrations,
right.
As a matter of fact, in the Reagan administration, I believe as undersecretary in the Department of Defense.
He was Secretary of the Navy.
Secretary of the Navy, excuse me. That's right. You're right. As Secretary of the Navy under Ronald Reagan. Which means that he's familiar with Republican presidential policy as well as the Democratic. And he ran as a Democrat in the state of Virginia for U.S. Senate. And
he switched party registration.
Yeah,
to
he
run
switched
as
party
a,
to do that.
And honestly, that's what partially you got to remember something about primary politics. Primary politics, the candidates run toward the base. In other words,
yes.
On the Republican side, you have to please the conservative wing of the party or you're not going to win. Hence, Donald Trump, who is no conservative but is saying the right things to the conservative wing of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And on the left side, this is why Bernie Sanders has a very strong showing in the primaries is because he's talking socialism to socialists.
Well, exactly. He's giving red meat to the lions.
And Hillary actually has a track record of being a concessionist to what are supposedly business interests.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that a good portion of the Democratic Party is corporatist?
Corporatist, definitely. Now, where Webb's problem is, okay, he's a turncoat. He used to be one of them. And, in fact, right. He served in the administration of Satan himself.
Self, Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. That's right. And he served in a big part. This wasn't like he was under...
And he's a hawk on defense.
So. Undersecretary of the Bureau of Weights and Measures. He was the Secretary of the Navy at the time when Ronald Reagan was 600-ship Navy, if you recall that going on. And the liberals were apoplectic because Ronald Reagan wanted this huge Navy. Okay, that makes him suspect. And
sure,
and Webb, right. As a Democratic senator, would have been called a moderate.
Yes, he would have, because he's a military hawk, strong on military defense. He's fairly libertarian in his social viewpoint.
Bingo.
Which means that he probably is okay with the left's view on abortion and gay rights, but he's also, you know, he could be flexible, and he probably wouldn't go as far as they would want to go on either one of those issues. So basically what Jim Webb did was he created for himself what I think he considers the best exit strategy possible, which is go out the door with the threat that I'll be back and you can't control me because I won't be part playing in your sandbox.
Exactly. Here's the one problem I see with a Webb third party run. He's got to find a sugar daddy fast.
I would assume that backing out like this, what he's anticipating, and this is me just putting on my, you know, prognostication spectacles, is that he's anticipating that if Hillary is the nominee, there will be people who in the Democratic Party who are worried about her, especially all of her baggage, and they might be looking for an exit strategy. Or if Bernie Sanders is the nominee with his outright socialism, that the corporatist entities will look at him as a reasonable alternative.
Well, honestly, he would be a great candidate if it ended up being something like either Bernie Sanders or Hillary versus a Bush or a Kasich or a Rubio or those kinds of candidates. He would be a great alternative. Now, and he would probably get a lot of support because he would be palatable to the libertarian wing of the Republican Party.
Yes, he would.
He wouldn't have the baggage associated with party politics.
No, not really.
Because he's already said, I've a pox on both houses.
Right, so he's basically the walking dictionary definition of bipartisanship.
Yes, exactly. So that goes a long way right now.
It does.
Okay, if you'd said this 4 or 8 years ago, not so much.
This would have been, okay, he's crazy, and he's done, and we're not going to be talking about him. But in this environment, the other thing, Charles, and I'm not advocating for this, mind
right.
you.
We're simply giving you the scenario.
We're simply looking at scenarios. And the other scenario is, by backing out of the Democratic primary process and going independent, he also makes himself a potentially attractive positioning for being on the vice presidential ticket for the Republican nominee, should it be someone like a Donald Trump?
Well, if somebody's trying to do what in Britain they call a national ticket.
Yes.
Little inside baseball. But in Britain, they run slates of candidates because they have a multiple party system. They have like 4 or 5 parties, 3 of which are really what you would call more or less major parties. And if nobody's got a clear advantage, what happens is somebody will put together a coalition. There will be an election because the prime minister is not voted for in an election. You may have heard that Pierre Trudeau's son was just last night, when we were recording this on Wednesday, was just elected Prime Minister of Canada. Well, they don't have a prime ministerial election.
His party won
the majority of votes
in their legislature, and therefore, then, since he is the titular head of their he becomes the prime minister, the person, because they control the levers.
As a matter of formality, he's the leader of the party, and therefore, and he got elected to his seat, and so did more of his colleagues than the other party, the other major party up there. So therefore, his party will choose him as the prime minister.
Absolutely.
And he will be required to put together a cabinet, and that cabinet will be voted on by parliament. Well, on a national ticket, if not, there's not a clear winner, there's not a clear huge majority of seats, then what happens is several prime ministerial candidates will get together and recruit members from other parties try to put together what they call a national ticket or a coalition government.
Exactly, which is the same as you have in Israel, and the same as you have in many other countries where there are multiple parties all competing for control. You don't have to have a full majority of 50% plus one. You can win an election through plurality and coalition building.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people don't know that this is out of nowhere and has nothing to do with anything. We're not making any accusations. I'm merely using it as an example. Adolf Hitler was elected with the Reichschancellor, which is essentially the prime minister
of Germany.
It's a slightly different office, but we'll let it stand for that. With 34% of the vote. He had 34% of the delegates. That means that 66% of the delegates were not Nazis.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
They were Christian Democrats. There were royalists. I can't remember which party, but the royalists were people who wanted to bring back the Kaiser. Hitler was able to put together a coalition government, and then he declared a state of emergency. That's how he became Der Führer.
Right.
And I'm not saying that's going to happen in Canada. I'm not too worried about that. People in Canada are not suffering under the economic and social problems that Germany was in 1932.
Sure.
So it's not ripe for that kind of thing. However, that's how a parliamentary system works. So if you want to know the difference between the United States of America, which is a Republican form of government, a parliamentary system is also a Republican form, but the way the leadership is chosen and who leads the government is different, because we have an executive head of government. Mm-hmm. Generally, they do too, but it's chosen differently than ours is.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So getting back to this, Webb would look good from that perspective, because all of a sudden you're creating a coalition. It wouldn't be the first time that had ever happened in Republican politics, because during Lincoln's second term in 1864, who did he pick?
I'm sorry, during Lincoln's second term?
Lincoln's second term. Who did he pick as his running mate?
Andrew Johnson.
Who was?
A Democrat. Yeah, he was a Democrat.
And in fact, Adolf Hitler.
I just passed my history exam. Yeah. Okay, I'm happy.
Abraham Lincoln did not run on the Republican ticket in his second term.
No, he did not.
He ran under the Union ticket.
Union ticket, that's right.
And the Union ticket had Andrew Johnson, who was a Democrat.
That's right. So it was a mixed coalition.
It was an attempt. It was a successful attempt.
Yes, it was.
To create a coalition ticket. And it worked.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, I think it's interesting, going back to Jim Webb and this whole idea of coalition. One of his announced reasons for leaving the Democratic primary was that he was not comfortable with many of the party's political positions. Now, what does that mean? That means that he can then continue to be a hawk on defense. He can moderate himself or morph himself into a at least partial pro-life position. He can work. Well, he can become an economic free market guy. Because obviously, with Bernie being so popular, socialism is the Democratic Party's milieu, and that's not Webb's cup of tea. So the other thing that he might be, and I'm going to, a couple things. Number one, you and I were both right. He was an undersecretary, because that was where he started in the Reagan administration, was as an undersecretary in the Department of Defense for some, I forget what it was. It was some Oh, I had it here just a minute ago.
The exact office.
First Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs. So in the military reserve.
Wow, there's a buy-off position.
Right. Well, he was there for 3 years, and then he became Secretary of the Navy. So you and I were both right. It was like, okay, so we're good. But, you know, when it gets right down to it, Webb is positioning himself also, Chuck. If he really does want to make a fully independent run, there's another individual whose name is starting to pop up again, whose name was popped up and actually was running during the 2012 cycle as an independent. I think he ran, maybe he ran as a Libertarian candidate. No, I don't think he was the Libertarian candidate, but it was Gary Johnson from New Mexico. And Gary Johnson, his name is starting to come back up again, and he's starting to make noises that he may be in the market to run again. Now, Gary Johnson is a libertarian's libertarian, is what I understand. Is, you know, the drug legalization, you know, social policy leftist, things of that nature. So it could be an interesting mix with the Jim Webb Gary Johnson potential ticket as a third party alternative. Now, let's not kid ourselves, they won't win. But they would give both parties a hot foot as far as their ballot support, which might make the Democratic and Republican tussle for the actual presidency after the nominations are all done a much more, shall we say, embracing experience for both parties. In other words, I don't think anybody could run away with a vote with a significant third-party challenge happening. Do you know, I believe that third-party challenge is ever going to happen? Probably not, because, again, it takes serious resources in order to mount a serious campaign. That's just the reality and the nature of our politics today. And I don't believe that Webb's base or Gary Johnson's base have the wherewithal to play in the big show. And the big show is after the party's nomination process, when it's down to the head-to-head from the Republican nominee and the Democratic nominee of who's going to control the lever in the White House.
Yeah. Gary Johnson was the Libertarian candidate.
He was the Libertarian candidate.
In 2012.
Okay, good, because I'm glad you looked that up while I was chatting there. But so there are all kinds of reasons why Jim Webb stepped out of this and is still trying to keep his brand viable. So I think find it interesting, Chuck, because maybe he might have figured out another potential path to not being a servant or a subject,
yes,
but being a kingmaker.
Yeah.
If he can bring enough with him, then he can help influence which side of the two-party coin that we normally flip every 4 years actually comes up on the face.
Well, think about this. There has to be a lot of money involved in any independent run. Because
yes, there does.
Think about Ross Perot.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, Ross Perot did exactly what he was supposed to do. Ross Perot was a Clintonista. As much as he said he wasn't, he was. He supposedly threw the vote in 1992 from George H.W. Bush, the Bush 41, to Clinton. I'll be quite honest. I've seen a couple of breakdowns of that vote. It looks to me like he drew pretty equally from both sides of that election.
Yeah.
If you recall, Perot went through this weird period where he was he was an independent presidential candidate, and then he wasn't. And he withdrew because George H.W. Bush supposedly threatened his daughter's wedding.
whatever that is. Let's back up a little bit. Drawing equally from both sides actually isn't equal.
That's
because
true.
Because if you look at registration in this country of political parties, Democrats are registered more strongly than Republicans in Ohio and in, I think, about just every other state in the union. So if you draw equally from both parties as raw numbers, you're actually percentage-wise hurting Republicans more than you're hurting Democrats.
Yes, because supposedly Republicans have to fight for... here's the deal, and we're going to have a show on this particular subject because it takes a lot of explaining. But you have to look into the Electoral College to understand why this all matters. And people get apoplectic when you start talking in terms of a majority of votes doesn't necessarily mean an election of a president. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a good thing.
Yes, it is.
I hate to tell you, and people say, we had a lady in our class in one of our Constitution classes who could not get it through her head, and we explained it every way I could think of, that it was a good thing that the Electoral College doesn't work by majority vote. It works by a vote of the majority in a specific state. And the way it's supposed to work, really the original design was, it's supposed to work from a majority in a specific congressional district. And I actually do a lecture, and then, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to see this, it's about 50 minutes. I will come and give it to your group. If you want me to come to your group, your church, your Tea Party group, your civic group, and explain how the Electoral College is supposed to work, contact me at vicechairman@principledpolicy.com. vicechairman@principledpolicy.com. And what you find out is that the way that they worked out the Electoral College was it was supposed to go by congressional district. But it was left in the hands of the states to decide that. And guess what? The politicians in the states immediately, within just a few years, co-opted the system and turned it into a majority vote deal and turned it into a thing where the masses were manipulated for votes.
Mm-hmm.
This is why the modern electoral system as it exists now with the two parties, you can blame Andrew Jackson.
Yes.
Okay. And honestly, the real architect is really a guy who was one of my favorite presidents. And almost nobody's heard of him. I can remember. I said, who's your favorite president? Martin Van Buren.
Martin Van Buren.
Who? So Martin Van Buren. One term. And this is a guy who...
Wasn't that Lucy's brother in Peanuts?
Her dad.
Her dad.
And, yeah. No. And this is a guy who basically saw a depression. There was a depression in the United States. What did he do? He cut government spending and he cut taxes.
A radical. What
yeah.
a radical.
Yeah. Instead of doing just the opposite. And basically, he kept a bad depression from going much worse. So that being said, you do have to take into consideration, A, the Electoral College, B, sure. the third-party card.
Right.
Because there are scenarios under which we were looking at one under Perot where he could have gotten a couple states.
Yes, he could have.
And what he did was he self-sabotaged his that. With that withdrawal thing yes. and acting a little crazy, you know, the crazy act that he did there, he torpedoed himself from actually winning a couple of states. I mean, right. it looked like he was ahead in, for instance, like Vermont, I believe, states like that are kind of split like Minnesota.
Right. Mostly states where he would have only picked up three electoral votes.
Exactly.
At best.
And all he would have done was change the... Because if you remember, the Electoral College requires a majority of the electoral votes.
Right.
Not a plurality.
Right.
It's and people don't sometimes don't know the difference. Okay, a majority is 50% plus one.
Or 270 electoral votes.
Yeah, 270, period.
Yes.
Because there's 438.
Right.
So you got to have 270. Or no electo. It goes to the House of Representatives. And believe me, you're looking at that scenario, and gosh, that just brings something to mind that I didn't even think about.
Can I stop you?
Yeah.
It's 538.
538.
538.
Yeah, because there's 100 senators.
Yeah, exactly. You forgot the senators. Yeah. There's 538 yeah. electoral votes possible. 269 is roughly half of that, so you have to have 270 dead on in
yeah.
order to win.
Yeah.
That's it.
269... Goes to the House.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Goes to the House. Now, that just got my brain to fire.
That's what I smell. Okay.
Okay, yeah. That horrible chemical smell.
That's it. All right, good. It's
what's
good.
Left of my brain cells good. Firing off. No, that makes what's going on in the House right now of tantamount importance.
Yes, it does.
Because
it makes it of significant importance. So fill it.
Okay, fill in the blanks.
Just tease us a little bit, because we are going to talk about that here in a few minutes.
There is a function that the currently sitting House does.
Yes.
In terms of an election thrown to the House of Representatives.
That's right.
And that is the sitting House of Representatives, not the new one.
Exactly.
The sitting one.
Right, not the one that will come in after the election, the one that's still there until January.
The one that sits right now is the one who would elect a president.
That's exactly right.
Should it be thrown to the House of Representatives.
Yes, that's exactly right.
They have to take the top three candidates.
Right.
And choose which one of those top three candidates will be president of the United States.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So that scenario now comes into play, and it really comes into play with who's sitting in the speaker's chair.
It does. And we're going to get to that in a couple of minutes. We're just going to hang people on here a little bit, because before we get back to there, we kind of have to take a little bit of a circuitous route around to it, because we're going to be talking about another major announcement that was made just actually today, as a matter of fact, as we record this. And that was, and this is still with the Democrats, so we're still following up from last week, the likely potential announcement was that Vice President Joe Biden would be jumping into the Democratic presidential race.
Oh, it made it into the newspapers going to happen.
That was dead certain. As of this morning, Joe Biden, in a public speech, with his wife and President Obama with him this morning, announced he is not going to challenge for the Democratic nomination. He is, before he even enters, he is withdrawing, Chuck. And this is significant, too. And I say that for a number of reasons. Number one, it basically stops a lot of speculation that Joe would come in as a unifier and as someone who could continue to carry on the Obama legacy, which opens the door right back up to my speculation of an October surprise. I think this is October surprise part one. I'm looking for the other shoe to drop on October surprise, that because I found it interesting, Joe makes this announcement with his wife with him and with President Obama. But nobody else was on stage. I still think, and I'm going to put this out here, and you all can call me crazy if you want to, and I hope I am crazy. I hope that I am totally off base on this one, that it defies belief that I'm that far off base. I still think Michelle Obama is going to announce. I still think that is part of the game plan.
Okay. I'm going to disagree with you.
You go right ahead.
I think the quote-unquote unifier, everybody's going to start looking around. Okay, who isn't a complete raving socialist publicly? Because they know that's going to lose in the election.
Mm-hmm.
And who can unite the wings of the party in a coherent fashion? And I think it's O'Malley.
You see, I'm having a little trouble with O'Malley, because O'Malley has a significant problem. Unless, of course, he goes the Bruce Jenner route, which is he's white and he's male. And he's upper crust and he's privileged, which is not the meme that the Democratic Party is trying to continue to foster in the culture and in the voters. They keep wanting to talk about women and minorities and disproportionately disadvantaged and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And even Hillary Clinton herself last week made some kind of a comment about the Republicans only putting forward rich white males. She forgot to look around her on the same stage to find out that on either side of her were rich white males who were the alternative should she not be the nominee for the Democratic Party.
Well, that's
they have a PR problem on their hands, my friend.
Yeah,
they have a major PR problem on their hands, because number one, Hillary is getting close to implosion. Everybody, the media is falling all over themselves to say how wonderful she was in the debate and how ready she is to lead and how she walked away with the field. But you know what? Bernie Sanders is still leading in every poll in every state that they're taking polling in the Democratic Party.
Well, let me tell you something. Why is that? Why is the they know they're basically going to knock Hillary off the pedestal. You know why? because they're Bernie people. The media is virtually to them. They like Sanders better,
better. Many of them do, but when push comes to shove, they are going to end up going with the legacy rather than with Santa Claus. Okay, they're going to go with the Clinton legacy over Bernie Santa Claus Sanders, who's promising. I somebody ran numbers on all the things that he was promising in the debate.
Oh yeah,
and it was like the cost of everything he was promising, from free education to free health care to free. I mean, he loves the word free. Problem is that the price tag for all that free stuff was $18.1 trillion, which is
the current debt.
The current United States debt, not counting all the fee services and things.
Well, look, here's the deal. If you think about this, if you recall, Obama more than doubled
the current
deficit, not debt, deficit. And look, it hasn't collapsed the economy yet. Maybe we can do it. Maybe we can pull the rabbit out of the hat again. Well, that takes us to $36 trillion. You're getting pretty close to the worldwide GDP. Okay.
You're right.
Yeah. Now, you can't keep creating wealth from nothing. Mm-hmm. And that is what's required. You've got to create wealth. The only way to create wealth is to take the raw materials God has given you and apply human ingenuity and work and sweat and tears to it to make it something that someone else needs or wants. Well, you can't do that without a profit incentive.
That's right.
And you can't, there is no profit incentive if you allow someone to make a profit and then take it all away from them in taxes.
As Denmark is finding out.
Yes.
Yeah. I just saw a report on the country of Denmark where, think about this. Taxes on an automobile is 180% of the cost of the automobile. So you think about this. If you pay $20,000 for a automobile in Denmark, and that's the sticker price is $20,000, you're going to pay $36,000 in taxes on top of it. So it's a $56,000 vehicle.
With two-thirds of it being the taxes.
Exactly. So what you're dealing with, Chuck, is the fact that socialism only works until you run out of other people's money. Okay, yeah. The old Margaret Thatcher line.
Yeah.
Another reason why I'm thinking this is a hat tip and a hint is something that Joe Biden was quoted as saying in this press conference announcing his departure from the non-entry and continued non-entry into the Democratic primary. And what he said was, quote, "This party, our nation, will be making a tragic mistake if we walk away or attempt to undo the Obama legacy." So in other words, he's saying, just because I'm not going to be the one carrying the flag, the party needs to continue the legacy. Chuck, I'm sorry, maybe I am reading too much into this, and you know, you all can give me like shots on this, and I'll take them. That's fine, you know, and our listeners can give me shots and say I've lost my mind and I need to go check into a mental institution.
www.principledpolicy.com.
Come on over and give us your feedback. But the whole point is that I still think this is a scripted play to move Michelle Obama in as a consensus nominee in the Democratic Party. Now, maybe they don't announce it now. Maybe they wait until right before the filing deadline.
I'll be quite honest, too much lightning rod.
It very well could be, but it's a lightning rod now, that nobody in the Republican Party, save Donald Trump and maybe Ted Cruz, could pick up and hold in their hands to counter.
Yeah.
Everybody else would get electrocuted by
it. One thing I will say, it wouldn't be a bad move from this standpoint. There's a lot of really stupid conservatives out there. Now, and by that
present company excluded, I hope.
by that I mean, all you have to do is go out and see some of the really dumb things that get said on comment boards about Michelle.
I try to avoid comment boards like the plague if I can keep
from. I watch them to see what the pulse is.
Okay.
And really, it's just really dumb things that she's ugly, she looks like this, and it's like, you don't have to insult her looks. First of all, she's not a bad-looking woman. She's an attractive woman. I mean, she's, she's 50 years old and 50 plus, and she looks fine. What you can insult is the fact that she's lost her. She basically gave up her law license before they took it away from her, and so did he.
Correct.
And there are reasons for that. The things she did in the Chicago school system are simply unforgivable. Things she's done in offices that she's run prove that she's basically incapable of running for president. That's the kind of commentary we ought to be seeing. So as far as becoming a lightning rod, you're going to see all kinds of stupid things being said. Some of the same stupid things that were said about Obama. Why say stupid things when there's so many smart things that can be said that are critical of him, that are true, rather than, oh, you know, the Kenyan and, you know, that kind of stuff? Look, the fact is, the whole controversy over him being born outside the country is bunk. The people don't understand what natural born citizen means. I'm not saying he was born outside the country. I don't think he was. I think he was born in Hawaii of an American mother, which makes him a citizen. It doesn't make him a natural born citizen according to the constitutional language, because that is someone whose father is either born here or a naturalized citizen. That is a natural born citizen. Now, if you want to argue that that's a stupid way of defining who can run for president, hey, that's debatable. I personally think that that ought to be amended out.
Okay.
That's what makes Ted Cruz ineligible. Nonetheless, sure. That is essentially someone who is not going to get disqualified, especially now that we have the precedent of Barack Obama. Because, you know, what are we going to get? Some birthers on the left. I think that was attempted early on, and it's not going to work. That well has been poisoned. Okay. So, that being said, you're right. What it could become a serious advantage, because what you do is draw the crazies out. And what that does is it motivates the base on the left side to get out there and support and protect her.
That's
okay,
true.
I get that. And in fact, you may have a point on that basis. So I'm not going to dismiss it entirely. I'm going to say I'll take a wait-and-see attitude. And if you turn out to be right, well, I'll take you out to lunch or something.
Absolutely.
For the last time, because then all our money will be gone if she gets elected.
That's true. Okay, so Joe Biden is now out of the discussion, out of the dream casting, out of the picture for the Democratic presidential nomination. So, you know, that was the first October surprise, I think,
right,
that the Democratic Party got.
Sort of. He's been telegraphing that he wasn't going to run, though.
Well, actually, no. As of yesterday, he actually did two speeches where he was really seriously intimating his record versus Hillary's. But today, oh, I'm not going to challenge Hillary Clinton, da-da-da-da-da. So, in other words, what he's signaling there as well is that Team Obama sees Hillary as being the number one person to challenge.
Can I tell you to go out and look at the Drudge Report today? Now,
oh,
ladies
sure,
and gentlemen,
sure.
By the time this airs, this will be gone.
Yeah, of course.
But basically, because Biden withdrew today,
yes.
Again, we're recording on Wednesday, the headline says, Biden scared away. And there's a picture of Hillary in a black pantsuit with a pointed witch hat.
Oh, okay. Well, you got to hand it to them. They love to put visuals
Drudge
on there.
Loves the Drudge visuals.
Now, here's somebody else who is scaring away people who previously sought to embrace him. And this gets back around. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming back around to the teaser that Chuck put out there earlier about the House of Representatives. Because, as we all know, there is a brouhaha. We have a speaker who is still the speaker, and maybe still the speaker past the date where he said he's not going to be the speaker anymore. John Boehner, you know, has chosen to vacate his own chair and step down, and he announced originally October 31st as the date that he was leaving, which will be after this program airs, but will be the day that our next program will air, so we won't even know if it comes
right
to pass for the next 2 weeks. But then when the presumptive heir to the throne, and I say that with no pun intended because it's dead serious, the heir to the throne, Kevin McCarthy, was found to have not enough support to even get through the caucus nominating process, much less the full vote on the House floor for Speaker. Then everything got a little gray and muddy. Boehner is now announcing nothing. There's been no confirmations or no denials that he would stay in the Speaker's chair, although the assumption is if there isn't a Speaker that's picked and voted on by October 31st, John Boehner most likely will not leave. He will stay in the chair. But he won't stay there probably for very long because you have still out there a motion to vacate the chair that's being brought forth by some of the conservatives in the caucus. And that was part of the reason why John Boehner chose to step out before that vote could be brought to the floor. So now, Chuck, because this whole issue with the who will be the House Speaker going into if an election has to get kicked over to the House, now we have a situation where many of those folks who would have been supportive of John Boehner's hand-picked successor, Kevin McCarthy, are now trying to recruit, and I don't think it's too hard of a job. I'll tell you that right now. I think that this is kind of, you know, phase two.
Right.
They're recruiting the House Ways and Means Chairman, Paul Ryan, who's a congressman from Wisconsin, whose name's familiar to everybody, because he was Mitt Romney's running mate in the 2012 presidential election for vice president. Paul Ryan has, I think, Chuck, this is one of those things where some people probably should have been thinking a little bit more clearly, and I think we kind of intimated this last week, before going out publicly and announcing how much they would support a Paul Ryan candidacy for House Speaker. And I'm just going to name names here. Chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, Jim Jordan from Ohio. And I love Jim. He's a great guy. But back on the 11th, which is about 10 days ago, he publicly announced that the House Freedom Caucus would, quote unquote, look favorably upon Paul Ryan's nomination as Speaker. Now, remember, this was 10 days ago, Chuck. Okay. And this was on Fox News Sunday, so people could go back and find it, and they can look it up. They can set out there and just basically understand where it was. When Chris Wallace asked about Jim Jordan about the group's support for Ryan, Jordan said, quote, "If he gets in the race, I think our group would look favorably on him," unquote. Now, this was before Ryan, this was when his name first came up.
Right.
Okay. And it's interesting, Jordan said, quote, "This is not just about who the next speaker is. It's about what's going to change the business-as-usual attitude. That's what we're focused on. The next speaker has to be committed to that." And he says, and then he goes on, he says, "I think Paul would be," unquote. Okay, let's roll the clock forward now to 1 day ago when Paul Ryan met with, and over on Monday, I believe, Paul Ryan, so 2 days before this taping, Paul Ryan met with members of the House Freedom Caucus. And yesterday, he met with the Republican Conference, the House Republican Conference, and last night, this would have been on Tuesday night, Paul Ryan said, "I would be your nominee as Speaker only under certain conditions." Okay, now Chuck, again, I think, God bless him, Jim Jordan should have probably held his powder dry until they heard Paul Ryan. Now, I do know at this point, having heard him, that I believe there is less warmth and less embrace of a Paul Ryan speakership actually changing things from business as usual. Does he want to change things from business as usual? Oh, yes,
he does. Oh, yes, he does.
Oh, yes, he does. Does he want to change things from business as usual the way the House Freedom Caucus wants it to be changed?
No.
Not on your life.
Not even close.
Okay? Basically, Paul Ryan, who both John Boehner and Harry Reid, that's the Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat, have both said they think he's wonderful and be a great speaker, and Reid said I could work with him. Okay, regardless of the partisanship of Republican and Democrat aside, when you've got a progressive liberal like Harry Reid saying, I think I can work with this guy, riddle me this, Riddler, why is the House Freedom Caucus, which is made up of probably some of the most conservative members of the United States House of Representatives, even remotely coming out and breathing that they might look favorably upon what is turning out to be, and we've known, you and I have known, because we've said it before, just the next cog in the establishment machine.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't care how you feel out in listener land about Paul Ryan. He's just the cog in the establishment machine. He was picked by Mitt Romney's campaign to be the vice presidential nominee because he was willing to moderate all of his positions, especially those on life and on gay marriage and court, and be one of the recipients of a great deal of largesse from hardcore progressive billionaires who want to change the Republican Party to look like the Democratic Party.
Exactly. Basically, a lot of gambling interests, a lot of big money, vice stuff.
Exactly. Well, and we talked about this on previous programs.
Oh, we talked about it in 2012.
Go out and Google up our archives at principledpolicy.com and type in Paul Ryan's name. You'll find a bunch of stuff out there because we talked about this incessantly during the campaign about the Trojan horse effect. And folks, those who will not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. There is no change from the Paul Ryan of 2012 to the Paul Ryan of 2015, who is now making demands in order to be nominated speaker. Now, what has he said? He basically, number one, he is making no promises to anybody. In other words, he will not let he will not give the Freedom Caucuses any assurance of anything positive. He wants the everything to be driven by the speaker, all policy decisions, which means no change from what John Boehner was doing.
Right.
He asked for something, Chuck, and of course now his spokesman's out there today trying to backpedal and walk away from it, unsuccessfully, of course. He basically said that he would only accept the office that if they would
if the House would vote.
If the House would change the rule procedures in the motion to vacate the chair. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this isn't a new rule. This isn't something that the House Freedom Caucus came up with in 2015. This rule was put into effect in the legislature, in the Congress of the United States, in the House, in the early 1800s by Thomas Jefferson. It was a means to keep a Speaker of the House from becoming a tyrant. It is a weapon to, if a Speaker goes off and becomes a unilateral autocrat, for the members of the House to be able to depose that Speaker and put in place someone else. This is the tool that the Freedom Caucus used on John Boehner. But this is the tool that Paul Ryan wants to basically, if it's a hammer, he wants to take the hammer head off. He wants to wrap the handle in foam rubber, a gooey foam rubber, and then he doesn't want you to be able to pick it up against him.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's what it gets down to.
This is very similar to the fact that the Senate changed the cloture.
Exactly.
The cloture rules. And the cloture rules, you and I had a disagreement at one point, and you basically talked me into it because I said I didn't like the cloture rules. The cloture rules basically are required on certain votes. You're required to have a cloture vote, and what that means is you need a supermajority to allow the bill to continue to be voted on.
Right, to end debate and vote the bill.
End debate, vote the bill. And you need a supermajority. I think you need 67 votes with a full Senate. Okay, I said I didn't like that. Well, you talked me into it, and you said that was the way they came up with to make sure that things like, okay, think about this, ladies and gentlemen, in the House, or I mean in the Senate.
In the Senate, yes.
51 senators are required to be present to do business. What's a majority of 51? 26. Right. So 26 senators can make a decision for all 100.
Yes, that's the problem.
Okay, what happens when you have 67% of 26? Or of 50?
Of 50, yeah.
Well, you're at 33.
Yeah, you're 33.
Yeah. So you've got something far more difficult to a hurdle that's a little harder to deal with than that 26. So what that does is basically, and the scenario where there would only be 26 present is pretty rare. Or I'm sorry, 51 present would be pretty rare. So I'm mixing up my numbers here.
It's okay. So
basically what that does is it requires a what would be very close to an actual majority of the Senate to be there to decide whether debate will end and there will be a vote.
An actual vote, yes.
And so I changed my mind, and thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Once you explained it to me, I said, yeah, that's beautiful. And now it sent me back this whole thing about this vacate the chair thing. I said, okay, I can remember a few years ago when we were studying parliamentary procedure, and in fact, in a group that I sit on the board on, I just looked at the bylaws. And one of the things people were you know, I mentioned the fact that sometimes it's in the bylaws that you can change your bylaws with a majority of members present. And I said, no, you do not want that. And I said, not only that, you don't want it to be 50% or 50% plus one. You want a supermajority, 60 or 67%. And they didn't understand why. And I go, because what that does is it can create an anarchy. You can create a situation where a tiny number of your board or at that point, I did the calculations. I said, 3 members. If you've got 8 members of your board, 3 members can change your bylaws. You do not want that. That is a disaster waiting to happen. And this is exactly what Ryan wants to do. What Ryan wants to do is create a situation where you can't remove the speaker. Well, any parliamentary procedure has a procedure for removing a chairman, which is what the speaker is.
Right, correct.
Removing a chairman if he becomes a tyrant.
Right,
or exactly. If he becomes mentally incapacitated in some way.
Exactly. It's not speaker for life, but that's what Paul Ryan obviously is wanting. Now, we're going to parse here for just a few minutes his spokesperson's comments on this issue. Now, his spokesperson is a gentleman by the name of Brendan Buck. Now, Brendan Buck is nobody to anybody unless you're John Boehner, who he worked for before he went to work for Paul Ryan in this position. So you're starting to see some of the links starting to form, okay? But basically on Tuesday night, when reporters got wind of this, of his comments to the caucus that you can't demand anything of me, I set the agenda and we kill the motion to vacate the chair, that he says, quote, Ryan, quote, believes there needs to be a change to the process for a motion to vacate the chair. Well, when pushed on this, Buck said, and he's responding an email, he wasn't actually in front of these people, or else they probably would have pegged him. Quote, and I want you to think about this quote, Chuck. No matter who is speaker, they cannot be successful with this weapon pointed at them all the time, unquote. What's the first question that should come to everybody's mind? What do you mean by successful? Obviously, if they're doing the will of the people and they're doing the will of their caucus, that's success, and they won't have to worry about this weapon pointed at them. But if they're doing the will of K Street and they're doing the will of the big money donors and they are quashing members of their caucus and not allowing them to be able to represent the people that voted them to represent them, then that speaker should have that weapon pointed at them. It's called a check and a balance, and it's an internal check and balance within the body itself. Because there's really few other checks and balances within that body. Now, the speaker himself has a check and balance, because if a member starts ponying up and starts getting out of hand, he can remove him from a committee. He can take away a chairmanship. He can bust him down to, junior. He can actually, the leader of each political party's chamber can actually ban a member from caucusing with that chamber. Those are all weapons that the leader has against the members. This is the only real weapon that the members have against the leader.
That's right.
That's it. And Paul Ryan knows it because he wants to be successful, Chuck. And he can't be successful with this weapon pointed at him. What does that make you think of exactly. his policy and leadership agenda is going to look like? And who is he going to be answering to?
Well, I mean, this is a power grab, pure and simple. This is a GOPE power grab. Now, you brought up the fact that they can be removed from a chairmanship,
yes,
or a subcommittee chairmanship. Yes. When I say chairmanship, I mean a committee. Committee chairmanship or subcommittee chairmanship. How right. did this crisis really get snowballing?
Boehner removing somebody from a subcommittee chairmanship.
Well, okay. And who did who was the hatchet man?
Paul Ryan.
No.
Oh, no, that's right. It was Jason Chaffetz. That's
and
right.
And Jason Chaffetz is a candidate for...
Not anymore.
Well, okay, let's go on. Let's bring
okay,
that
go,
up in
go,
a second. Let me go on.
Finish up.
Okay, who did he remove? Mark Meadows. Mark Meadows is basically the guy who spearheaded. Now
he brought the motion to vacate.
Mark
Meadows is a Republican congressman from North Carolina. Jason Chaffetz removed him as a subcommittee head. Which basically takes away income too, because they get paid
sure.
to be a chairman.
They get a per diem to be a chairman. Yeah.
It also took away any kind of influence he had. So Meadows realized where this was coming from. It wasn't coming from Chaffetz. It was coming from Boehner. Because they had been critical of Boehner's leadership. And Meadows is in the Freedom. He's one of the founding members of the Freedom Caucus.
Exactly.
He brings the resolution, the motion to vacate. And then everything starts to happen. But now, you mentioned Jason Chaffetz.
Exactly.
Who also, during when it was looking like... Kevin McCarthy didn't have the votes, announced he was going to run for speaker, and basically shortly realized that nobody was going to support him either. But now he's turned, and he's publicly given his support to Paul Ryan.
Exactly. Because he knows he's going to be doing the same job for Paul Ryan he was doing for John Boehner.
Exactly. Now, it's interesting because the spokesperson for Paul Ryan said, quote, "Ryan is not proposing to eliminate the motion to vacate." Oh, no? Well, if it's not pointed at you, you've pretty much eliminated it, right?
Exactly.
Now, here's what he said. He kept saying this, quote, "It should exist. The process for how it can be used, however, should be changed. Open to different approaches," unquote. And then he didn't explain anything else. So, Chuck, how many different approaches do you think that Paul Ryan would be comfortable with? One where a member can bring a motion to vacate against the speaker? Or one in where the speaker has to allow a member to bring a motion to vacate the speaker's chair? Because that's the different approach they're talking about. And that is, you can't bring this motion unless you get leadership to support it, i.e. the speaker and or the majority whip or the majority floor leader to support the motion to vacate the chair. And honestly, Chuck, that isn't going to happen.
Okay, let's real quick, because we're going to run out of time. There's a saying by John Adams. I think it's revolutions are not won with majorities, but a dedicated, tireless minority. This is what's happening in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, that's Sam Adams, by the way.
Oh, it
John.
Is. You're right.
That's
you're
Samuel.
Right. It's Sam.
That's one of my favorite quotes from Sam Adams.
I just paraphrased it. It's a brilliant quote. And I don't have time to look it up.
Sure.
The fact is, you don't have to have a majority to win. This is showing in the House, because they have done major damage and good damage to the GOP establishment, because major damage has needed to be done to this group for decades.
Right. Now, let's not forget that during all of this kerfluffle from... Kevin McCarthy to Jason Chaffetz to Paul Ryan, there's still another person who has never withdrawn their nomination from the speakership, and that is Representative Daniel Webster from Florida.
Dan Webster.
Who is actually a founding member of the Freedom Caucus and who had the endorsement of the Freedom Caucus, which makes me wonder where Jim Jordan was 10 days ago when he was saying how they could back a Paul Ryan speakership. Now, maybe he's just looking at the political realities that they can't get the establishment enough votes to get Dan Webster as speaker. But I think if they push back hard enough, you could see Daniel Webster being the Speaker of the House of Representatives. But in the real nasty political world, probably isn't going to happen. But what we can hope is that, and of course, all the Tea Party groups and all the conservative groups now are furious with Paul Ryan, and they're making their voices heard to the Freedom Caucus members to basically stand strong and block Boehner 2.0.
Yep. Well, I'm going to sign off with that quote. It does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen on sending brush fires of freedom in the minds of men. And with that, we ask you to come out to our website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.